Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After listening, be sure to join our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to connect with the community and discuss the episode. Follow us and enable notifications on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss new episodes. You can also find all episodes and information on this subtype or your subtype on SFA's website, curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. On this episode, we sit down with Chris Berry, a rare disease patient and desmoid tumor survivor, dad, and civil engineer living in the San Francisco Bay Area. Diagnosed with familial adenomatous polyposis, or FAP, as a teenager and later with a large desmoid tumor, Chris has faced immense medical challenges, including chemotherapy, major surgeries, and an intestinal transplant, yet he continues to turn adversity into advocacy. Through this conversation and his personal reflections, this episode shines a light on the realities of living with a desmoid tumor and FAP, a diagnosis often described as benign or not that severe, a phrase that can be deeply misunderstood in the community. Join Chris as he shines a light on what benign can actually mean for a desmoid tumor patient, where his journey took him, and how he became involved in the sarcoma community to help advocate for others who find themselves in a similar position. Thank you so much, Chris, for joining us for this conversation. Let's dive in. Welcome to Sarcoma Stories, and welcome back if you are a regular listener. My name is Tasha. I'm one of your hosts.
Hi, and I'm Brandy. I'm your other host.
And today we are joined by Chris Berry. Chris is a rare disease patient and survivor of a desmoid tumor living in the San Francisco Bay Area and works as a civil engineer. But I will let Chris fully introduce himself. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me here, Tasha and Brandy. So like Tasha said, my name is Chris Berry. I'm a civil engineer in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm a husband and father to two daughters, ages 10 and 2, and I'm a rare disease survivor. I have FAP, familial adenomatous polyposis, and a desmoid tumor, and am an organ transplant recipient too.
We have so much to discuss with Chris today. So we're so grateful for you being here and being willing to share your story. So Chris, let's start with how your journey began, which I believe was at the age of 15.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes. Actually, it starts with my mom. She was 50 at the time. It was around 2000, 2001. She went in for her regular colonoscopy at the age of 50. And they noticed that she had an abnormally large amount of polyps, more so than what a typical 50-year-old woman should have. So they thought something was odd there. Longer story short, we did genetic testing. And then they found out that she was the carrier of the FAP gene, familial adenomatous polyposis, which is this hereditary condition causing colon polyps to grow in your colon and then increased cancer risk as you get older. So usually it's regular monitoring and tracking the polyps development over time. So that's when I was diagnosed with FAP. It's a simple blood test and it's a gene, so they can isolate it and see who has it. So I was 15, about sophomore in high school. That's when it started. At the time I was told it was not clear cut, but it's monitoring over time. Depending on how many polyps grow, we'll have a colectomy to remove the colon and to prevent cancer. Then you're done. That would be my journey. But that was far from it. That was just the beginning. At the age of 27, one of my doctors said I had a large amount of colon polyps, and then he recommended surgery to reduce the risk of cancer. So then I had a colectomy at the age of 27. And then that's when I thought the journey was over. Flash forward in a couple more years at the age of 30, I had a 2-year-old daughter. It was like right before Halloween, I thought I had the flu. I was sick. I was bedridden for a little bit. But going to work at this time, had night sweats. Just thought it was basic flu. And then eventually turned into abdominal pain or like side pain. And I thought, well, maybe that's appendicitis. So I went to the urgent care. They checked me, did some routine work. And then they said, oh, you might just want to go to the hospital down the street. Mm-hmm. I was like, whoa, what? It scared me a little bit, but still thinking that it was appendicitis or something normal and relatively minor. So I went to the ER with my wife and daughter. They did some x-rays. of the abdomen area. And they came back and they said that you have a tumor, a growth the size of about 20 to 23 centimeters wide. It's obviously a three-dimensional shape. It was roughly said it was like the size of a little smaller than a football. So that's when I was diagnosed, checked in the hospital. Eventually, I got a lot worse. I don't really remember my time there too much. I was kind of in and out of it, the drugs, the shock of it all. But I was in there for about 5 days, then released for another follow-up. And at that time, at home, just in our apartment in Los Angeles, we just, things got worse. And then we decided to go back to the hospital. That I was more familiar with during my routine checkups from the age of 15. I was familiar with those doctors. And that's when I checked in the hospital. And then they said it's a, at that point, they didn't even really know what it was. It was like a desmoid tumor, maybe a sarcoma. So it was very vague and didn't really understand the full diagnosis. They did a biopsy. It came back relatively inconclusive, had characteristics of both. And it was just frustrating never to get the proper diagnosis at the time. And eventually, oncologist said, it doesn't really matter what it is. We're just going to treat it like a sarcoma. So we went through 6 rounds of intense chemotherapy, which involved doxorubicin was the main one. It's nicknamed the Red Devil. So I was an inpatient for about 90 hours. It was like, check in pretty much Monday through Friday. And then it was pretty much constantly for 4 days straight. And then you get out, then you have a 3 week break, I guess, to recuperate. And then you repeat that cycle again for another 6 times total.
So when did you get diagnosed? Because you mentioned when you went from urgent care to the emergency room and they did the scan and they found the tumor, that's when you got diagnosed. Was that when they said, okay, you have something because we found a tumor? And then after the fact, you got diagnosed?
Yeah, so I went to the urgent care one night, then, I was there for probably about an hour, and they sent me to the ER. They did x-rays, and then that same night, and then they came back late that night, and they said, we found a growth. We're going to check you in upstairs. And then they did a biopsy of the growth. And that's when, it was sometime within that 12 to 24 hours.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure if they biopsied it there or if they referred you somewhere and then you went to the doctor and they ordered the biopsy. But it sounds like you got it all taken care of right then. So that's good.
Yeah.
So you were diagnosed with a desmoid tumor. People can sometimes refer to them as benign. And I think this is an important topic as it relates to desmoid tumors. And also people's understanding of what benign could actually mean, right? Because benign can mean it's nothing, you don't have to worry about it. That's most people's vocabulary of benign. And so I think that's a misnomer when you're talking about desmoid tumors, is that you do have to worry about them. So let's talk about that a little bit, because I think people need to understand the difference of, oh, it's a desmoid tumor, it's just benign. No, you still went through chemotherapy. Desmoid tumors don't metastasize necessarily, but that doesn't mean they're not something to be concerned about.
Correct.
And so can you talk about your experience with the conversations you had with your medical professionals in regard to that of, hey, this might not metastasize, but if they're benign, why did you have to go through chemotherapy?
Yeah, and that was a big part of the frustration at the beginning, just getting a proper what this is before we could treat it. And that was, so it was explained, it's desmoid tumors, they're benign, they're non, they don't metastasize, they don't spread to the parts of the body, but they are locally aggressive. That's how they explain it to me. So they act like a local cancer in the area. And especially when they're, like my case, they were in the abdomen. And that's just due to like kind of more of having FAP. That's where they pop up. So then they cause local damage. They are aggressive, they're fast growing, they're complex, and then unpredictable. So one of the things too is that's why they didn't want to do a lot of biopsies, because desmoid tumors tend to grow back if they're provoked, if they're cut, or if they're removed, they have a high propensity to come back. So they didn't want to take unnecessary biopsies just to figure out what it was. They're just like, hey, we're just gonna treat it like a sarcoma in this worst case scenario, just to hopefully reduce it in size so that maybe that they could do surgery and remove it.
So that was the goal of the chemo, is to reduce its size, make it smaller.
Yeah.
Surgically remove it.
I mean, the tumor itself was wrapped, it was around the mesenteric artery that kind of provides all the nutrients to the bowels. It was like, it's wrapped around it or embedded right next to it. So they had to shrink it. It shrunk, I think, by about like 40% to 50%, which is a good deal.
Wow.
Yeah. And it shrunk like an ice cube, so it was still wrapped around it. So eventually, like after the 6 rounds of chemo, they did a exploratory surgery to see if they could remove it. But when they got in, the surgeon, when he got in there, he said it was too close and he didn't want to risk anything further.
So after that, did they do more rounds of chemotherapy to try to shrink it further, or what did they do?
At that point, it was, so doxorubicin, that type of chemo I went through, there's a limit. The 6 rounds is the max. So that was like the most you can get in one lifetime. So at that point, it had shrunk by about half by volume. It wasn't really growing at that time. It was dormant, they called it. They couldn't really do much about it because it was embedded within the artery. So they couldn't remove it anyway without causing more complications in the quality of life. So it was just monitoring it. And then if it did grow back, then there would be other treatment options that we could talk about at that time. So that was fall of 2018 through end of 2020. And then in 2021, January 2021, that's when it started to regrow.
And in that time frame, so you finished 6 rounds of a very aggressive chemotherapy. Most of our listeners who are familiar with doxorubicin know that is a very aggressive chemo. And you do this, and then they're monitoring you. How was your quality of life in that time frame with it having shrunk but still being there? Did you have any symptoms? What was the quality of your life like in that time frame before it started to grow?
I would say it was good. I would say it's pretty much back to normal. Growing up, I was always a swimmer, played water polo, ran off and on. And then at that time in my life, like mid-20s to early 30s, I was running. So after that surgery, being bedridden for the most part and just having no energy, getting that energy back was great. It was kind of like a little freedom a little bit. So I got back into running at that point. So I was returning back to normal activities. I went back to work about 2 to 3 months after that surgery. So I resumed normal life pretty quickly afterwards. Yeah.
Did they notice it on a scan, or did you have pain when you found out it had started growing?
I'm trying to think. It's weird because during those times when you experience the pain, or at least from my experience, like it becomes a blur after the fact. I remember it was January 2021. It was like during the pandemic. So I was worried at that time too, just like with my previous condition. But I remember having pain. I remember we were at Target doing some shopping of some sort. And I just didn't feel well. I just got tired. And then we got home and I just remember I sat on the chair. And my wife was like, oh God, this is not good. This kind of reminds me back of what happened before, just lethargic and just didn't. I'm usually pretty active and I've always liked to do things, to go places. Yeah. So whenever she sees me not wanting to do anything or go anywhere, just sit down, she gets kind of a little worried. So that's kind of when it happened. I must have talked to my medical team up by our house and they said, come in for a blood test. I took a blood test and then I went home. I was in pain. I remember that. And then when they got the results from the blood test, they said, okay, you need to check into the ER.
It's interesting as you're talking, because I think sometimes when we talk about our journeys, it's okay. And then this happened and this happened. But one thing for you in your journey that I know has been a frustration point is the timeline isn't always clear and navigating that. And so do you feel like as you look back on that, you can recall that frustration? And what was it like for you navigating this journey?
It's definitely frustrating. It's especially when you have family and working and you seem fine, you're okay. Then you take a little relapse, you get worse, and then you get better. And then it's just frustration too of the cycle of it all. It takes emotional effect too. It's not myself, but also the family. Physical effect on myself. Just runs all the gauntlet of emotions and just, everything.
Yeah, it sounds like it, because I think there's in cancer diagnoses, a thought that once you get diagnosed and go through a treatment, you're done. And in your case, it's a ebb and a flow of a symptom pops up and you treat that, and then you are okay for a while, and you, like you just said in your words, you get your freedom back for a period of time, and you're adjusting to that, and then another symptom pops up, and it does sound like it takes a toll. It sounds exhausting to recall, let alone actually live. And as you're talking, I'm thinking your wife noticing how your affect is suddenly, and that must also take a toll on her while you're both raising two young children. How has that been for your wife too, and how has she played a role in this journey with you?
She's played a huge role. She's been my number one caretaker throughout this time. I'm glad right now I'm a post-transplant. I've been stable and healthy. So I'm just glad that part is over, especially for her, just so she can concentrate on herself and then doesn't have to worry about me as much. But yeah, at the time of my first of the desmoid tumor diagnosis, we had a two-year-old daughter. I was in the hospital the first time for 5 to 6 weeks. We were still living in LA, so we loved it down there. But we drive up for the treatments for the week. So we come up before, stay about a little bit after the treatments. So 2 weeks, and we go back to LA for 2 weeks. So it's kind of a cycle for her. And then she had having to pretty much deal with our daughter at the time. So that was stressful. And then kind of navigating the whole doctors. And then I think the frustration part too was most on her was just the diagnosis and what was going on. Because each time throughout my journey, you learn something new about the FAP, how they're related to desmoids or desmoids related to them as they happen. You know, like you get FAP and then it's, oh, here, look out for these things. It's, oh, yeah, this is related to that. And it's, oh, like you don't really, you didn't, you, I, we always learned the expectations after they had happened.
Yeah. Then like almost learning trial by error.
Yeah. Yeah. Then every time you see a doctor, they're like, oh, like they look at your case like, it's a special case.
Yeah.
Like, this is interesting, or, oh man, this is, it's not necessarily a good thing.
I want to get back to the locally aggressive part, because the fact that you were able to do chemotherapy up to the point where you couldn't anymore, and it had shrunk the tumor, but because they grow back, now it's grown back, and now you have to deal with the fact that it's growing again. And then you've had your treatment at that point, from what I understand, was a transplant. Is this, with desmoid tumors, something that will continue, right? Is it constantly, as Natasha said, I'm going to ebb and flow, or where you are now with the transplant, your medical team feels like you're in a much better place?
Desmoid tumors, yeah, they do tend to grow back after surgery. So that was always, that's why they couldn't do surgery. And that's why after this round in the hospital in January, 2021, ran through all our options. We couldn't do more chemo. I got the infection from the tumor, released some liquids into the bowels. Once they got the infection under control, it was just monitoring it. They couldn't really do much. But then we got a connection through a different surgeon who said he had worked with FAP patients and desmoid tumor patients. And he said, the only way you can really do it without them growing back is through an organ transplant, intestinal transplant. Oh, wow. So we had those questions. Well, if we do it, the transplant, would they grow back? So that's what we've heard. And he's, it won't grow back because it's different DNA. It's the donor's DNA. So they don't have in that intestine, it's not your DNA. So it doesn't have the FAP gene. Mm. That was what I was explained.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty, the whole ordeal, it was pretty crazy, the technology and learning about it.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I'm learning something new right now. Was that the decision maker then for you to go forward with the transplant?
Yeah, at that point, I was in the hospital, released, and then I was getting connected to other medical organizations in the area. And each one of them we met with, they couldn't really do much, or my case wasn't severe enough to have surgery or to have an organ transplant from someone local. So this one surgeon who was connected through a family friend, they said, hey, this is what we do. I can do this. Your quality of life will get dramatically better. You're young. You're in, you know, relatively good shape when you're healthy. So your quality of life will be a lot better. And then he didn't guarantee it would work, but he did that it would be successful. So that right there, the confidence is what kind of pushed me towards that.
And I ask, what was the conversation to say, you weren't severe enough. What does that mean exactly?
So at this time, the tumor had wrapped around the bowels and it constricted them. So I wasn't able to eat any food, drink any fluids, retain anything. I had a couple tubes in my stomach and then that would drain the fluids. And I was on TPN. So at that point, one of the doctors said, I don't qualify as a transplant patient because with the TPN, I was still like, I could live.
You were getting nutrients.
I was getting nutrients. So
that is wild. Yeah. That's really wild. Yeah. Like I personally feel that if someone can't eat, that's pretty urgent.
Yeah, right. I might be biased.
Yeah, that's severe. I might be biased. I did have a feeding tube during my treatment, so I know what it feels like to not be able to eat.
Yeah.
But that's really wild that made you not severe enough just simply because you were getting TPN nutrients. But if anyone's had TPN nutrients, so that is not the same quality of life as being able to eat and live your life. So that's wild. That's what the benchmark was.
Even with the TPN, that's the surgeon that performed the transplant. He said that after a while, even if you're on that for so long, it destroys your liver. Right. And it was almost like he's like, then you'll need a liver transplant at that
point.
Exactly.
You know, so, it's like whack-a-mole here, of like symptoms and issues coming up.
All that stuff played into the frustration too. It was just like,
wow.
Yeah.
I'm glad I asked that question because I was like, I couldn't understand like what is severe enough. And to hear what you say, you were severe enough. That's very interesting. And right, it's about quality of life. Yeah, technically I can live that. I can exist. It's not even live. I can exist. But eventually I'm going to have even more problems down the road. So why don't we just deal with it now?
Yeah. And the conversation around quality of life is interesting too, because that's going to differ from patient to patient. It's that, like that book, Being Mortal. That book talks about that quality of life. What one patient deems a quality of life that they are comfortable living is different from the other person. So it's interesting to talk about these benchmarks of you're not severe enough in this case. It's like, who is they saying you're not severe enough if that's a determinant of your quality of life being the life you want to live. So I think that is an interesting conversation, and especially around desmoid tumors, because I feel frustrated for you that you have to experience that. And that it makes more sense hearing these things as to why that journey is so frustrating for a desmoid patient.
Yeah. So that's very interesting. And also to know that because of the transplant, because they wouldn't carry that gene, you would then not have to worry about it in the future.
Yeah, he even said that if something were to grow back, we'd just remove it again. They just have another transplant.
Wow.
Yeah.
The body and science are wild. Yeah. So I actually have a question, though, about the gene. Your brother, you said, is FAP positive as well. Would they ever, for him, monitor and talk about doing a proactive transplant to avoid him possibly having a tumor? Is that a conversation?
Yeah, so he actually has two small desmoids in his bowel area too.
Oh, he does.
Yeah, I forget the size, but I think they're not as big as mine was. And I think they don't need to be removed, I guess, right now. They're not like a local threat.
Got it. So they're watching him.
Yeah.
I think we did talk about that. And then my medical team at with the transplant, they said, you don't want to do a transplant unless you have to. It's just, you know, it's probably one of the hardest things that post-transplant was, like, obviously the chemo and all that stuff, that was like emotionally, mentally taxing, and just like the 6 months of it. But after the transplant, that was probably the hardest time I've ever had to recover from something.
Yeah. And I want to talk about that. But for him, basically, this is so invasive. We don't want to do it unless we have to do it.
Yeah. So with desmoids too, they always want to monitor them until they become bigger. If they become more locally aggressive or cause a problem somewhere with some organ, or then they would do something about it at that point. But generally with desmoids, they leave them alone as long as possible until they have to. So they don't want to trigger more to grow, or they call them like make them angry and then grow more, go get more aggressive.
Yeah. I always find that term funny. Make the tumor angry. You're like, okay, I'm angry at the tumor. So what are we going to do about this?
I ask a question about your treatment journey. There has been an approval recently in desmoid tumors for an FDA approved therapy. Actually, it was just approved in Europe as well. And so while you were going through your treatment, were you talked to about, because it sounds to me it would have been around the time that the trial was opened, were you talked to at all about that potential trial or any trial in desmoid, that kind of conversation at all?
No, not that time. It was more after the chemo and the surgery. That first, it was just monitoring them. I think if I remember correctly, it was more to let my body recuperate to a little bit of time. So it's been over so much stress at that point, the 6 rounds of chemo and then the surgery, pretty much for about 9 months in total. So the oncologist at that point wanted to just kind of give me some time to rest, my body to grow or to recuperate. The tumor was dormant. It wasn't really, they didn't see it as being as aggressive.
Okay.
And it was like, if it started growing more again or growing back again, getting larger, then that's when they would take different treatments with the trials or other therapies or medications.
So it really sounds like the journey for you has been when it's dormant, just let it be. And then we deal with it as it grows back, which I imagine feels very uncertain at times.
Yeah, a lot of uncertainty.
You never know.
Because looking back, it's like each time it's not like you're just monitoring, oh, you can see it grow. It's more of it just hits you. And it's like I'm in large amount of pain and then you're in the hospital for a month and that's not sustainable.
Yeah, I guess my question is, how do you go about living your life in those in-between moments, not knowing when the next time it's going to come back happens? What kind of drives you in those in-between moments to just keep living your life?
I think I remember like before the desmoid tumor diagnosis, we were always adventurous. I would always want to explore places in California, especially with our young daughter. At that time we lived in Los Angeles. So we traveled, go to the beach a lot, go to the desert, the mountains. I remember I was diagnosed around Halloween, so end of October. So after my second round, after that New Year's, I remember just being in the hospital and then home ridden for two and a half months. I wanted to get out. So my brother lived with his family up in a little north of Seattle. So we did like a road trip. So I kind of just wanted to get back to the stuff we usually did or the best as we can. Yeah. The first time we drove from LA to Seattle, it's, geez, I don't know, like 15 hours. So it's a pretty big road trip, especially between chemo sessions. So I mean, at that point, we didn't really know the uncertainty. So maybe it was like, probably in my head, I was like, I don't know how long I could live for. So I want to do these things, especially with my young daughter and my wife, and live how we used to. Mm-hmm. And over time, I still kept that mentality, but just enjoy each day when you're healthy. It's like we go to the beach a lot. Even if I couldn't go swimming, play in the sand with my daughter, we go to the park. I remember one of my friends still had a wedding. The oncologist at the time said, hey, we can postpone the chemo a week so you can go to this wedding. So lived life as normally as possible, given the circumstances.
Yeah. Keep living.
Yeah.
Sounds like you didn't even stop living. You just kept living within the limitations and the new challenges that you were faced with.
Yeah. And then I think at the beginning it became extreme because you don't know how much time you have. And then obviously that's not sustainable because you can't do that every day. So then it gets slower and then you can miss the day-to-day things. Just waking up, maybe taking your daughter to preschool or just walking to the park, getting coffee with your wife, going to a museum or something like that.
Yeah. The little things are actually
the little things. That's one of the things I learned is that the little things are how much you appreciate and almost take for granted sometimes the little things.
Yeah.
Just in life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So now you're post-transplant. What was the recovery like from the transplant that you had to have?
So the transplant, so I had it August 2021. I was on pace to be released like in 2 weeks, I think.
Wow.
It's a process. I've had surgeries before at that point. I've had at least two previous ones. And the recovery time, getting up to walk, is usually within a day or two. This one, it was all the tubes. I woke up and I was taped to the bed. I had all these tubes in my mouth. I couldn't move. So it was pretty scary at that point. But then you get used to it. But then just slowly just dealing with things and just learning how to walk again. Getting that strength back little by little. Just the pain and the constant monitoring by the different personnel. There's always someone in the room, at least for the first week. I couldn't really move on pretty heavy set medications. It was really painful. The surgery went pretty much from my sternum all the way down past my belly button. Then I had like other tubes and apparatus in different sections of my sides just to drain fluids or to monitor how the transplant was going.
That is a huge recovery. I imagine how painful that is. So were you in an ICU during that first kind of week? And then where did they transition you to?
Yeah, I was in the ICU, I think for the first, at least for the first day. And they, then they have each, they had a specific transplant ward that's cordoned off from the rest of the hospital. You have a special like clearance to get up there. At the time, it was during COVID, so only one family member could visit.
Wow.
Just for, and then, especially with transplant, you have no immunity. You're on these anti-suppression, anti-immunity suppression meds. I was on pace to get out within 15 to 20 days, which they said was pretty good for the transplant. But then I got a virus, so that kind of prolonged my stay and another month. So I took after the whole stay after transplant was about, I want to say 6 weeks.
And this is during COVID too, a time that's even more critical for someone who's immune compromised. You just had this transplant, makes you immune compromised. What was that recovery like during COVID? Because you already have to be cautious. Did you have to be more cautious?
Yeah, yeah, I chose to be more cautious. There's always a threat of on transplants of just getting anything. Like you just don't. But it was more so after being released, that's when the kind of, even today, just in general, like the flu or any kind of virus, like I'm susceptible to it. So just, you have to do things your own way, take your own precautions. Yeah. You can't really rely on other people to
protect you.
Yeah.
How has that shaped your daily life now post-transplant? Because you're a few years out now, but what is different for you and how you live your life now being a bit more immunocompromised?
It's a lot of medications. So I take, I think, 40 pills a day. Got to have it down, you know, but for the first couple years, it's like pretty intense to remember what to take, when to take it. But now it's more of a habit. It's not too bad. But it's just more of, because with transplant patients, it's just anything. So it's like foodborne illnesses, airborne illnesses. So it's just being cautious of everything. You can't live in a bubble, but you just have to take what precautions you can. And you got to realize that sometimes it could maybe offend or upset someone, but you just gotta protect yourself, especially if other people are sick or if you're eating certain foods that may be more risky than others. You don't want to get sick
yourself.
So
you're not eating much raw sushi anymore.
No, I had to give that up. Yeah. Oysters are one of my favorite things.
You were talking and I was literally imagining oysters. I was like, I bet you that's a no.
Yeah. My oldest daughter, she wants to go to Japan, to Tokyo. And I'm like, oh, man, I don't.
There's not a lot of food options for me right now.
But I'll have to pack my own suitcase worth of food to go.
But in general, go back to living your own life. You just take what precautions you can. My wife and I, we travel still. We went to, you know, Europe a couple times. We go to Mexico. What I've learned is not, maybe it's just my philosophy. I'm going to take the precautions I need to be healthy and to not get me sick, but I'm still going to live my life how I want to and the best way I can.
I think that's an important message for people to hear, because it's a really difficult challenge you've been through, and you could go about it many different ways. You could say, okay, now I live in this bubble, but then you wouldn't be living your life. Or you could say, I'm going to do the best I can and I'm still going to live my life, which is a thread throughout your whole journey that's kept you going. And I think that's important, is to keep what's important to you in front of you as you're moving through these difficulties.
Exactly.
Yeah. What would you say has been the impact, if any, on sort of your mental health throughout this journey? Because that's one thing we don't talk about a lot, but I heard early on in the conversation, you made a small comment about it. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to circle back to that, because people's journeys last a long time. But yours has, I keep going back to what Natasha said, ebbed and flowed for a long time. And the impact on your mental health throughout all of that, I'd like to know if it impacted at all, and then how you've dealt with that, and then dealt with it with your family as well, because that had to have impacted them.
Yeah, it definitely impacted them. It's kind of go through the stages, like shock. You just go through everything. You go through it as maybe not linear, but just go through each stage as they come. So I remember like the first diagnosis, it was each time this is more the shock, this is happening or this is happening again. The uncertainty of what's the end of this going to be? Is it going to be everything be okay? Is it going to be more serious? One thing I learned is just that I kind of keep my emotions inside a lot just as a person, but it's important to let your feelings out, especially during these times, and your emotions out. Just express how you feel and just listen to your family, let them just open forum, just how you, everyone is being affected or by this disease or cancer. I think that as a man, it's sometimes it's hard to get around. You have to provoke this kind of being a fearless, strong person. And I think that during these medical journeys, especially with my, mine with desmoid tumors, it's realizing that courage comes in different ways. And for me, it's realizing that courage isn't about being fearless. It's about moving forward despite the pain, despite the fears, or the uncertainty of the disease or cancer. It's about showing up, asking for help from your support team, your doctors, your friends, family, feeling joy, enjoying those small moments of everyday life, and taking each step day by day, just taking every little action you can, because even a small action leads to a bigger action. But then every small act, whether it's, for me, it was running. For a lot of people, it's laughing, sharing your story is courage in action, but getting your story out there. And we're not alone. And each day you keep going, you know, we're keep on showing our incredible strength just throughout the process and journey.
That's such an important message. I'm so glad you shared that. I think hearing that from you is maybe the push someone needs to take the step of courage in their own life.
One of the things you also said, I think in some of the pre-information you gave us, was you use the word lonely and it being a rare disease and the fact that a rare disease can often be lonely as well. And we hear that a lot, actually, that a sarcoma diagnosis is a very lonely diagnosis. But then as you break sarcoma down into the over 100 different subtypes that we have, each subtype is an even smaller patient population. And so you have a small population as a whole broken down to even smaller. So you don't find too many other people that might be going through the same journey as you. Were you able to connect with other people that had desmoid? And can you talk about the, of it being lonely and where you found information about desmoid and outreach that you could find?
It is lonely, especially with rare diseases, because you don't really meet anyone with them. They're not really talked about or have the marketing behind them like other diseases or other cancers organizations that behind them, because obviously the numbers are lower. But one of the things I remember after my chemo in 2018, I just wanted to know more about organizations that kind of affect me or with the desmoid tumors. And that's where I came across the Desmoid Tumor Research Foundation. So actually I got in touch with them. One of my main goals was to, I've always been a runner, so I wanted to put on a charity race at that time. And so I reached out to them. Just, I've seen things like on Instagram or social media about other influencers doing that of some sorts. So I thought, oh, maybe I can do one small one locally, raise awareness for desmoid tumors or sarcomas. So I reached out to them. I still haven't done it, but it's in the works, hopefully. But through them, I was able to, they had a engagement in San Francisco in 2018. They invited me to share my story there. So I talked for a little bit, and then at that conference, met other desmoid tumor patients of all sorts, whether they're in their extremities, their neck, their abdomens. I just seeing there's other people out there, especially around me, because all other people were from the San Francisco Bay Area or Sacramento. So just seeing that I wasn't the only one, it was good to talk to them, to meet them, hear their stories, see the similar experiences that everyone goes through. At that time, I was still living in LA, and I always wanted to do the LA Marathon. I had ran it as a relay with family. So I was looking for organizations that I could run with that had teams there together to raise money or just to meet other people there. And I saw that the National Organization of Rare Disorders had a team at one point. So I reached out to them. They had to like cancel the team out of LA because they're from the East Coast. It wasn't, I guess, the support just wasn't there on the West Coast. But through them, that's when I got connected to run. We were like, oh, we have a spot on the Boston Marathon coming up. Do you want to run from them? So just get word of mouth and just Google, look it up, organizations and that advocated for desmoid tumors. And that's how I got connected to them. And just meeting other people, either in person, remotely.
SFA has marathon teams too. So you're going to have to look and sign up to help us also raise awareness for desmoid tumors and, for other people who are experiencing what you're going through. I think it's really important. And it's important to get connected to people that share the same journey that you have as well. One of the other questions I had was about the FAP diagnosis and the connection to desmoid. And is that something that's a known connection? It sounds to me like it is a known connection between FAP and desmoid, but how much conversation prior to your desmoid diagnosis did you have about a potential connection between FAP and desmoid, and any monitoring or anything that you should be aware of or the doctors would look for? And how much education do you think people in the FAP community or even the desmoid community would have about this potential connection?
Before my desmoid tumor diagnosis, I knew nothing about desmoids. There was no talk about any connection between desmoids and FAP. It wasn't until actually after the diagnosis, that's why with the biopsy, it was inconclusive. It was kind of like, sarcoma, desmoid? They leaned towards desmoid because of my history with FAP. That's what I explained to me, that they're connected and that people with FAP, if they have a desmoid, they develop a desmoid, it's usually in the abdomen, where most other people that don't have FAP can be in the extremities. That was the connection that I've been told.
That's good to know. It's a way to get information out to people, because there may be some people who have been diagnosed with desmoid and may not know they had FAP because their mother wasn't diagnosed with it or a family member wasn't. So they might not even know they have that genetic connection.
My gastroenterologist, they've given me a lot more information about the FAP and the desmoids after all this as currently. But they said it's more about each case is unique in each family. So with FAP, there's the classic FAP, which is you start developing polyps around 10 years old. Then you probably need surgery probably like in your 20s, early 20s maybe. It's more aggressive. Then there's AFAP, which is the version my family has, which is attenuated FAP, which is it just sets on a little later. So maybe like in high school, like between 15 and 18. But they said my case is like a mix between the classic and the FAP because it's more aggressive in the desmoids, but it's still AFAP. So maybe it could be just hard to cover everything.
Yeah. It is interesting though, because you've had such an interwoven / overlapping journey with these rare things. And from what you share, it sounds like you do a lot of work to help raise awareness for the rare diagnoses you've encountered from one to the next in your journey. What kind of role has being an advocate played for you now in your life currently and throughout your recovery?
Yeah, after the first diagnosis in 2018, I wanted to move away from just being a victim to maybe more an advocate. So that's when I reached out to the Desmoid Tumor Research Foundation and then NORD, just I didn't really know how to be involved. I just knew I wanted to do something. And running came naturally because obviously there's races all over the place. And then it's relatively easy to run. I just think you just need to.
For some of us, Chris. Yeah. For some of us, not all of us.
But I just want to do something. So that's how that started. And then meeting people through those, especially with the desmoid tumor research, meeting other desmoid tumor patients. And then through NORD, meeting other rare disease patients, especially with younger kids. You see like the impact that generally rare diseases have on everyone, especially young kids. It's hard to see. And then the parents living through that just wanted me to do something. So it's turned my story into a positive, and then also give me a reason to exercise, get back out, do something bigger than myself.
Yeah, that's really great. Yeah, I think the do something bigger than yourself, I relate to that a lot, just taking the darker moments of your life and not necessarily finding a reason or a purpose to it all, but just trying to take something that's been very challenging and and make a difference for other people. And it's, I really have no doubt you're doing that with the communities you've put yourself in since your own diagnoses. I feel like even as somebody in the sarcoma space, my understanding of desmoid tumors has, I feel like I've misunderstood them until talking to people who have lived those experiences. Even reading literature, I still feel like I had a misunderstanding. So I think you just sharing that and explaining that, I think helps really eliminate that. Would you say you feel like they're misunderstood?
Yes, I do. I just even explain them. I remember like the first part, it's even like how they're benign, and it's how people are like, oh, they're benign, so they're not, it's nothing to really worry about. Yeah. I was like, what? No, right. It's like locally. So it's like having to, the more you have to explain things, it's just the harder it is for people to grasp. People get other types of cancer just by hearing them. Obviously, they're more prevalent, so they see them, they hear about them, especially with the, you know, desmoids with the benign part, or they don't spread. It's okay, you'll be okay.
They're not. Kind of get brushed off. Okay, yeah. You're fine.
They don't spread, so you're fine. No, that's not exactly true. That's not true. Yeah. Right. What do you want people to know from your perspective? Because I think that was one thing that when you reach out to SFA, I think that is the one thing that resonated the most with me was the lack of awareness, the lack of understanding, and that the rare matters. And so what is it that you would want people to know about your journey, about what is it that you want to leave people with? What would you like people to know about desmoids? Is there one thing you could tell them about desmoid tumors? What would you want people to know?
I think the main thing I want to leave people with is just the diagnosis is not necessarily the end. There's so much more to accomplish and to do after the diagnosis, and doesn't necessarily mean you have to run marathons or do something extravagant. It's just finding your own little, your niche, your therapeutic release. I think that's what the running was for me. I think just talking about your story so that you can help other people understand what you're going through, so that you can encourage other people that may be going through the same thing, so it's not stigmatized, and then you can help increase advocacy and then create a larger community for the desmoid tumor, the more people know about it. And the more support it can get, the more funding it can get, the more just notoriety it can get. Desmoid tumors, they should be taken seriously. I remember my oncologist was back and forth what it was. He just got to a point where he was like, it is cancer. That's what I consider it as. So I think you just got to treat it as what it is. It meets pretty much all the definitions of a cancer, of a sarcoma. It acts like one. And it should be treated like one, and it should be characterized as one.
You're absolutely right. And I think that's a challenge that is often lost in the conversation as it relates to people diagnosed with desmoid tumors is, again, circling back to how we started this conversation with it's benign or it doesn't metastasize. And so you don't have to worry so much about it. But in fact, you do. Not just the quality of life, but in your case, you ended up having to have a transplant. What could that have looked like for you had that not happened for you? So I think that's an important note that you make is we as SFA, Chris, you as an advocate, all of us as advocates have to make sure we are spreading that message that it affects people regardless of whether it might metastasize and get aggressive in that way, it's still an aggressive disease and it still needs to be treated as such.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that leads to my final question. If someone wanted to reach out to you, you strike me as someone who is an incredible support to the other people you meet in the desmoid, in the rare community. If someone wanted to reach out and connect with you, is there a place they could do that?
Yeah, I think probably Facebook and Instagram are probably the easiest.
Perfect. And we will link that in the show notes if anybody wants to reach out to Chris. And that's also a good reminder that we have a Facebook group dedicated to Sarcoma Stories podcast. So you can join that Facebook group, connect with the guests, connect with other listeners. I think it's actually the largest Facebook group we have at SFA, which is really exciting. You can always join it and touch base with other listeners from around the world, which is super cool. Chris, I am so appreciative of you just being willing to share your story, coming on and sharing your story. You talked a little bit about courage, and sharing your story is a very courageous act. I'm so grateful for that and the message you left with our listeners today. So thank you so much for making the time in your life and in your schedule for being here and having this discussion with us.
Yeah, this is a great conversation. Thank you so much.
SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners, to amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients. SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.